Let's assume that we're all here, each of us, because we want to find God. Now, that may not be the most immediate reason you came to Oaks Parish this morning. You may have been pressured by a family member or threatened with the loss of vehicle access for a week if you didn't get out of the bed. But setting aside those shallower possibilities, there remains something in you that draws you in. Let's say that it's God. So where is he? How do we find him? It's not a small question, is it? But let's attempt at least a partial answer today. Our basic human wiring is to look for God in the spaces and people and events that give us a jolt of adrenaline, the ones that thrill our senses and really entertain us. And it's there where we believe we encounter the deepest aspects of life. We engage with the emotional fervor, right? And whatever the thing is and whatever emotion it might invoke, we love it. We love to shout approval as much as we love to be angry and shake our heads with contempt. CNN loves Trump as much as Fox News does. Only from different sides of the emotional spectrum. One lavishes praise, the other is appalled, but both opt for that over dull, boring, inactive, right? What no one wants is the mundane, the humdrum in life. We just think bigger and louder and provocative is where life is at its peak. Some of you attend or are graduates of a prestigious university, and you love Saturdays in the fall watching top-class football teams with the noise and the thrill of victory, right? And others of you go to Oregon State. Okay, see? It's a one-off, I promise. He's not asking me back. Sorry to offend half the crowd. In any case, when it comes to finding God, we look in the stadiums and on the stages with loud bands and flashing lights and celebrities and B-1 bombers, tanks, and in elections that go our way. And so we tend to transfer this impulse to the Christian faith. God is found in the explosion of emotional intensity and the ecstatic experiences. And we might be tempted to think that the gospel reading from St. John of the wedding at Cana is a way of John wowing his readers right out of the gate with this jaw-dropping miracle that wins the crowd. But it's not quite that way. It's much more subtle than that. What a strange story with which to begin his gospel. Certainly there were more significant and serious miracles and signs and sermons that Jesus gave that should have had the prominence of the opening vignette in the gospel. I mean, he healed the lame and the blind by merely speaking to them or even about them. He fed over 5,000 with a small lunch. He raised Lazarus from the dead. Surely those should be first in the story of Jesus. Instead, with the wedding at Cana, John takes a risk, and he risks losing his readers. He risks those readers thumbing their nose at the one he's described in chapter 1 as the eternal Logos. I mean, think about it. Really, Jesus? A magic trick at a wedding? And now we're suddenly going to follow you? I mean, Moses did greater miracles than that. He parted the Red Sea. He turned an entire river into blood. And you, Jesus, you've only changed 120 to 160 gallons into wine. And don't forget, for a while, even the Egyptian priests went toe-to-toe with Moses and with his miracles. No, John, If you want us to buy this word was with God and word was God business, we need a bit more than a magic trick. Such a strange, maybe ignominious start to the gospel and to this ministry. Besides this, turning water into wine, while mildly impressive, seems utterly trivial. Why bother? Here's an ordinary wedding, undocumented by historians except for John. We have no idea the names of the bride and groom, the master of ceremonies, the parents, or the relationship of any of these people to Jesus. The party has gone on for days, and the host is humiliated because he runs out of wine. An embarrassment, a faux pas, maybe, but not the worst failure in the world, especially not the sort that requires the miraculous services of the Son of God. In the grand scheme of things, this just seems trivial. And let's be honest, Jesus really shouldn't even be at an event like this, because no doubt the revelry was unbecoming for a rabbi, don't you think? Think about it. A celebration where there was so much alcohol being consumed that the custom was to wait until everyone was wasted and then bring out the inferior wine, because no one would notice. They would be so drunk. Is that the kind of place the second person of the Trinity should even be, much less contributing to the festivities? My church tradition, the one I grew up in, maybe some of you can identify with this, let's just call it extremely conservative. They viewed consuming alcohol as a sin, not a matter of wisdom, personal decision, but one of the worst things you could possibly do as a Christian. As a young child, I remember walking through the grocery store, and one person in my life would, when we got to a certain cooler in the grocery store, that person would pull me the other direction and sometimes cup my eyes and pull me over this way and say, she'd say, "Don't even look, don't even look. You'll be tempted by its lure." So I was taught, and I'm not joking here, I was taught that what Jesus changed from water into wine was pretty much the equivalent of Welch's grape juice. Because obviously Jesus wouldn't drink alcohol, and he certainly wouldn't give more to a bunch of people who were already drunk. You see what John's doing? It's strange. Why begin the gospel with this story? So much so that some of us feel the need to sort of explain it away. But in the middle of this nondescript event, we encounter the first of Jesus' signs to the world about who he really was. And St. John says in verse 11 that in doing this, he manifested his glory. And the disciples believed in him. An average day in an average village where an everyday couple tied the knot, the glory of God who created the universe gets revealed. Who would have imagined such a thing? Now, in St. John's gospel, glory and belief are heavily weighted terms with huge theological significance for both for us now and for the age that is yet to come. So it seems rather odd to say that the unmitigated inebriation of dozens of partygoers constitutes the manifestation of the glory of God in the world. But Jesus says in his high priestly prayer in this same book, chapter 17, that he has given them your glory. That's what he says about himself to the Father. I have given them, I have revealed your glory, Father. And then John explicitly states that his glory is manifested here at the wedding at Cana. The glory of the Father gets revealed in and through Jesus at the wedding of Cana when he transforms water into wine for a bunch of drunk people. there must be more here than meets the eye. It must mean that this really isn't about helping some friends out of a jam or Jesus' ability to change a liquid's molecular composition. St. John must be saying to his readers and to us, hey, here's the point. This is what God is all about. Take a listen. Dial in. It's about glory and belief and setting things right in the world. It's about feasting and weddings and good wine and blood and a cross and who's really in charge. And it's about getting married to God. Maybe some of our struggle, as I've already hinted with this story, is the extravagance. It's a lot of wine, especially when there's already been a lot of wine, and Jesus should just say, go sleep it off. But instead, he pours it on. Do you get that? John highlights how much wine is included. Gallons and gallons, in order to be absolutely sure that no one is excluded, that everyone gets their fill. He could have taken only one of the water jars and filled it, and that would have been plenty. But his instructions are to fill all six, a preposterous amount for guests in that condition. More and more wine and more wine and yet another cup of wine. And there seemingly was no end to the wine. The jars, John tells us, was there for the Jewish rites of purification. Purification that was necessary before coming into worship. It was a sign that people were ready and willing to get close to God. They were looking for God. How do we find God? And the Talmud gives very detailed instructions about this purification process before coming into worship. And only a small cup was needed to purify 100 people, the Talmud tells us. But in Cana, Jesus provides enough water and then wine to purify the whole world. Yes, the whole world. What could he be trying to tell us? I've always been fascinated by Jesus' response to Mary. Did you cringe a little bit when you heard it? Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. Bit harsh, Jesus. Okay, take it easy. She is your mother. Doesn't make sense for him to respond this way to her request. What do you mean my hour hasn't come? These people just wanted to save face. They just wanted a little bit more wine. But he wasn't telling her, I'm not going to get involved, right? Because he immediately gives instructions to the servants to fill up the water jars and give them wine. So what's Jesus thinking about here? Clearly he's on a different level than just an absence of wine at a wedding. Whenever Jesus says, my hour, he's always referring to his own death. His hour was his divine appointment with the cross where he would bleed and die. So what he seems to be saying to Mary is something like, I can't give you my wine just yet. You're asking for wine from me, and I can't give it to you yet. It's not time. The wine of my blood is what I'm really here to give you. You'll have to wait for that. But for now, I'll give you a sign of what that wine will be like. I'll give you just a taste. And it turns out that just a taste of that wine was the best wine. Was the best possible wine. It's so good that even when you've had your fill of all the other wine, of all the other good stuff that this world has to offer, and you're drunk on inferior wines out there, Jesus' wine grabs your heart. and will cause you to be amazed and will change you from the inside out. And that's what happens that day in Cana. Jesus gives a sign of what the wine of his blood tastes like, the wine of his blood. And the master of the feast marvels at it. This doesn't just happen, he said. This wine is different. Incidentally, did you pick up on the fact that he seems to be oblivious to the fact that Jesus performed the miracle? No grandstanding, no big event at Moda Center. Jesus didn't even let the MC know at a small village wedding that he had done that. So quietly, anyone in this unexpected, strange, out-of-the-way location, come and taste this wine that's different than any you've ever had. How remarkable. Later, during their final Passover meal together, Jesus takes the cup of wine and tells his disciples that this wine is his blood. Drink up. Wine, blood, Jesus, enough for the whole world. Gallons and gallons and gallons of it. See, rather than become bothered by the extravagance of wine in the story, we've got to remember that the wine itself isn't the point. John says that this is a sign that that's there to pull us into a different reality, to jolt us out of our normal way of seeing the world, and to impress upon us that the real world is more than our finite minds can possibly comprehend. I'm afraid the point of the story isn't that Jesus has the power to take the basic stuff of our life and turn it into something delicious, although he does. Jesus is saying that he is the real purification. And there's enough of him to go around. You think all of that water in those jars will cleanse you and get you before God, my fellow Nazarites? No. It's me. It's my blood. It's a wine like you've never had before. He is the real purification. And John says that in this, he manifested his glory. His glory. The glory of God is a gendered ancient Jew who comes to a world that's full of human beings who are drunk with all the pleasures and gods of this world. And he insists on them drinking his wine, the wine of his blood. The wine that causes them to have their eyes open and their senses enthralled so that now they understand how there's never been a wine like that wine. Have you ever tasted that wine? The kind that would cause your heart to run after him and to leave what the world has to offer? That's where you find God. And if you have tasted it, do you now find yourself languishing with the cares of motherhood or career, what you'll do in retirement, or as you suffer the loss of divorce or the death of a dear loved one? My friend, there is yet more wine for you. More of his blood, which is more of the life of God himself in the simple, everyday, unspectacular meal of bread and wine. Jesus says, here I am. Come and taste and be filled with the life of God. Who would have thought that we'd find God here? And the glory of God broke out during this out-of-the-way party in a small, obscure village in a country about the tenth of the size of Oregon. The way that St. John wanted the world to know who our God is and what he's all about was to take us to Cana and to learn about wine. I wonder if he would still have his glory break out today in unexpected ways and unexpected places. I wonder if God still does that and wants to do that. I wonder if he wants to do it with you. Shock you, surprise you, Mary said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." This from the one who chatted with Gabriel and was impregnated by the Spirit of God. You'd expect something a little deeper, wouldn't you? And all she said was, "Do whatever he tells you." I don't know if that was her expression or not. "But I want more." And so they do. They did the absurd. They filled up all 6 jars. Crazy. Why would he tell us to do this? Of all things, seems useless, not to mention exhausting. But they did. And when they did, the glory of God broke out. For better or for worse, God has chosen to do his work in the world through people like you and me. He has united himself to us so that when he wants his glory to shine, he does it through servants who just do whatever he tells them to do. The Spirit of God fills the people of God by word and sacrament with the life in Christ so that when we do whatever he tells us to do, the glory of God can break out. And sometimes we have a role and sometimes we're just there when it happens. Some years ago when I was in vocational church ministry, one Sunday I was standing by the door of the church speaking to folks as they exited the sanctuary at the end of worship. And off to the side, I noticed a young man whom I didn't recognize, and he was waiting, clearly, for an opportunity to chat with me. He looked nervous, which made me nervous. He asked if we could speak privately, which made me more nervous, but we found an empty office, and he proceeded to tell me how he got there that day. His wife was a traveling nurse, and he was just kind of along for the ride. He didn't attend church anywhere, and before that day, he had not believed in God. For some reason that he couldn't express, he got up that Sunday morning, and he decided to go somewhere to church. And he found ours on the internet, realized it wasn't far away from where he was staying, and he walked the mile or so to get there, passing, incidentally, several other churches along the way. He told me that something had happened to him that morning that he couldn't understand, and he wondered if I might explain it to him. He said that as he sat through the service, he seemed to lose sense of where he was and what was happening, and he said, "No offense, Pastor, but I honestly couldn't tell you anything that you said today." I thought, well, get in line, buddy. There are a bunch of people like you out there. But at some point in the service, he said, I started writing down what was coming to mind about God and what needed to be different about my life. This is a true story. This is exactly what he told me. And he read his list to me. And it was a list of repentance of sin. And it was an expression of faith in Jesus Christ. Now, he didn't have those exact words in his vocabulary, right? But that's what it was. And I did my best to explain more about Christ and about faith. And as the conversation was ending, he stopped and he looked at me. He said, "I should really tell my friends about this, don't you think?" I said, "Yeah, that's a good idea." And on an average day, in an average church, in an average city, while we were just doing whatever God told us to do, glory broke out. Friends, come. Drink his wine. Be filled with his life. And then go out to do whatever he has commanded you to do. And may his glory break out. Amen.